Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Paul Sweeney. Join us each day for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen. And always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.
Right now on markets, Sarah Hunt joins us this morning. I was looking at the operating income of the banks with Goldman Sachs coming out. And their profit growth is there, but it's not tech-like. Are they profitable, and are they a growing profitable entity, the big banks, or are they not?
Well, the big banks are just getting bigger, right? So to the extent that the regional banks are suffering because the bigger banks are getting bigger, there is growth there. Is it tech-like growth? No. But if you start to see some other areas pick up, like capital markets, which has essentially been moribund for the last couple of years, mm-hmm. they're pointing to some opening in some of those areas. I think the bigger banks continue to get bigger, and I think in that sense there's growth. But no, it's not going to be a hockey stick like some of the tech stocks.
So, sir, I mean, we're getting into the meat of earnings here this week here. What are you looking for this earnings cycle from some of the leading players?
It's a combination of what the first quarter looked like and what their expectations are for the rest of the year, because I think that given where the valuations are in the equity markets and all the geopolitical tensions that we're talking about, you're at some fairly lofty valuation levels. So you need to see some real earnings come through here. And to the extent that people are already expecting earnings to be better, they need to not just be better, but the going forward has to look pretty good as well.
So, I mean, it's interesting. You talk about valuation, and we've had this big, big move for equity prices off those October lows, up 25% plus for the S&P 500. I don't think we've seen necessarily that type of earnings expansion as well. So where are we in terms of valuation here?
We're on the higher end, right? So to the extent that some of the technology stocks have got the hockey stick growth that is supporting multiples because people are expecting the earnings to grow into those multiples, so the multiples will come down because the earnings are coming up. But I think if you look at the market as a whole, we're on that higher end on the multiple side, and it's been a real multiple expansion more than an earnings catch-up, and if the earnings don't actually end up coming through, I think you have some vulnerability there.
So what do you do if you're in the game? You know, there's a lot. I often talk about people that have missed this bull market. Let's say I'm in it. And there's like stage two, stage three, the whatever. How do you treat cash right now? I mean, if you're trying to be an adult and you're running at 5% cash or 8% cash, do you want to build that or do you want to put money to work right now?
It's a combination of things. I think there's nothing wrong with having something like a 5% cash position, somewhere in between that. The higher up you go, the more you become at risk of not really managing money if you're supposed to be an equity manager, right? You want to be looking at what's going on. I think the market has broadened out. I think that there's some opportunities in some of the spaces. I mean, I've talked about energy for ages, but certainly what's going on right now, you've got some longer term better prospects for the energy group, which is unfortunate because of the geopolitical situation. But that combined with the energy transition story means you're seeing some higher oil prices.
3-month T-bill, 5.38%. 1-year T-bill, shockingly lower, 5.15%.
Tom, I mean, you're...
That's like 90-day money.
You're all set there in your triple all-leverage cash fund here. So
what do you want to go through it? I learned this weekend, we just did the end-of-quarter review. I got a 2-20 payout.
Nice.
It's great.
Okay,
you know, we grossed out 13.5%.
Nice.
There's some fees involved.
There's some fees.
You know,
everybody's got to get paid.
And, you know, net clean, we got 2-20.
Sarah, so what do we do here? I mean, again, technology's been the leader in this market since I can't remember when. And is that still the case here? Does technology need to drive this market forward?
This is the question of the week, folks. Sweeney just asked. This is everything.
I think the answer is yes. I mean, if you just look at where the growth is, it's on technology. So do you need other things to do well as well? Yes, you do. But if you really saw a problem with technology, that's going to be a problem for the entire market. I think it does need to keep that leadership.
So are you a buyer in this whole AI stuff? Tom and I are still trying to figure out what AI means. But
Sweeney went down to Duke this weekend.
Got smart.
Well, you look at all the areas that are going to be impacted by it. There's a huge spend going on right now because of it. And the question is, how is that going to make us profitable? Because the real issue with AI is, can I get my margins up by using it in some way? And the questions are sort of like, AI, question mark, I'm going to make more money. Mm-hmm. That question mark is coming through for some of the players, yeah, like Microsoft and some of the cloud players. It's going to be a question going forward how you actually monetize
all that. I typed in Microsoft as you were going. I got 30 seconds. Microsoft pre-COVID, 38 billion, 38 billion free cash flow. Oh, it's almost a double. The arch question to, yep, Paul's great question, can this juggernaut be sustained? You're saying yes.
Well, I'm saying that they need to continue to show growth. And that if they show growth, then the juggernaut will be sustained. If the growth slows down, that's going to be a big question mark, how the rest of the market reacts as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Good. Sarah, thanks for getting us started this week. Sarah Hunt with us. Greatly, greatly appreciate that. With Alpine Woods Capital Investors. I thought of Ian Bremmer four, five, six times this weekend,
yep,
because you need to describe our G0 certitude, our comfort, our lack of warfare on the soil of the United States and then other G7 nations with what's going on out there. He codified the phrase G0, and we're honored that Dr. Bremmer could join us this morning. What does the G7 do here? Of a Kissingerian diplomacy, Ian, you got to show up and be diplomatic if you can't talk to the other side. How should the G7 respond?
They're showing as much support as they can for the defense of Israel. And that is both intended to show Israel that they are not isolated in the global stage, despite the war in Gaza and all of the opposition to that war over the past months, that the Iranian strikes, in a sense, are the higher priority for the G7, but that they don't want to see, they really resist, mm-hmm, the potential for Israel to engage in strikes against Iran that could precipitate a direct war. And right now, I would argue, you've got Benny Gantz, largely sympathetic to that message, someone that would like to be the next prime minister of Israel, and he has a vote on that war cabinet. And you've got Benjamin, right, Netanyahu, who is fighting for his political, right, life and is not sympathetic to that argument. Gantz is saying this is the time that you should strengthen alliances with countries like the U.S. and Germany. And Netanyahu is saying this is the time we've got to hit the Iranians back directly, right, and hard, even if that means a more isolated and a more, right, unilateral Israel. That is the nature of the debate, right, inside Israel right now.
And what's so important here, folks, you know, you see Ian Bremmer and he's doing this media, that media, he's writing this book. And what you don't see is the granularism of his daily Eurasia note. And part of that, Ian, is about the structure of the Iranian government and a theocracy. Who's calling the shots in Iran right now? Do they have a legitimate government, or is it a theocracy that staggers back to 1979?
Look, you know that they don't have a legitimate government in the sense that the people don't have a voice. They don't have the ability to vote for them or vote them out. And indeed, there have been a lot of people, myself included, that have both believed and hoped that people power would be more successful in rising up against this brutal theocratic regime. But it is in place, it is stable, it is calling the shots internationally and domestically, and it does not want a war with the United States. And so I think the important thing I've been seeing on the media over the weekend,
please,
you know, how extraordinary it was that the Israelis were able to defend so well against 300 Iranian missiles and drones, that they knocked down 99% of them, and there were not any deaths, there were not any significant injuries. And that's a great story, but let us remember that the Iranians gave a heads up as to the nature and the timing of the attack to the Iraqis.
Why did they do that?
To the Turks.
Stop, Ian. Why did they do that? Flying over Iraq and Jordan. Why does the Iranians give it away? It's like pretend war.
Well, yeah, because I think they were trying to accomplish two things that are hard to do at the same time. They were trying to show a maximum display of force in responding to the Israeli strikes on Damascus that killed a high-level Iranian military official. And they were trying to minimize the likelihood that their show of force led to further attacks and brought them into a war they don't want to fight. So those two goals that they have are not exactly fully in alignment, Tom, right? And so what they did was they tipped their cards. They showed their hand through the Turks and the Iraqis to the Americans. So the United States had the ability to send the CENTCOM commander to Israel to coordinate a response to get your vessels and your aircraft in place in advance, to let the Israelis know what was going to happen, to tell the Israelis privately and publicly that there was ironclad support for Israeli defense. In other words, give the Israelis a bear hug.
Yep.
Help defend them as best you can, but also help constrain them and constrain specifically the prime minister in making it hard for him to engage in full-throated right. military response following this Iranian attack. That's exactly what the Iranians were hoping to accomplish. By the way, it was also following the U.S. playbook in the 1 week following the Iranian proxy attacks that killed three American servicemen and women in Jordan. The Americans did the same thing. And so I'm sure that the Iranians figured, because it's a dangerous thing for them to do, it worked for America, the U.S. is going to get it if we do the same thing in response.
Ian, we're 6 months into this conflict here. I think I speak for a lot of folks when I say we just have no idea how Israel will get out of this situation today versus day one. How do you think this plays out going forward?
I think most people are focused on Iran right now and less on Gaza. That will, of course, change back given the nature of the horrible civilian casualties, the famine that's going on, and the rest. But this does give the Israeli prime minister and his right-wing government more of a lease on life. They're likely to be there for longer as opposed to forced out soon. That's a problem for Biden.
Right.
There's less focus on Gaza, which means that Netanyahu is going to have a harder time being restrained in terms of eventual ground assault on Rafah. I suspect it will be less dramatic, less overwhelming than he might have wanted to do before the U.S. ultimatum, and there'll be more humanitarian aid coming in. But I think those attacks are still happening, especially because it's harder to now get the Hamas breakthrough on the initial hostage release and the six-week ceasefire.
Ian, get some rest. You've been up all weekend. Ian Bremmer there, owning the high ground on our G0 realities. Dr. Bremmer, of course, with Eurasia Group. Look to his top 10 risks at the beginning of the year. My book of the summer with Chip Wars on our technology. So what we're going to do here is different. We have a former Supreme Commander of NATO, James Stavridis, vetted at one point as a vice presidential candidate by one of the sides, and Admiral Stavridis joins us this morning. Admiral, I want to talk about one thing. I want to talk about Arleigh Burke destroyers. Now, we had Spruance, one of my heroes. We had Spruance destroyers, and Elmo Zumwalt said, we got to do something fancier, and now there's Zumwalt destroyers and all that. How do Arleigh Burke destroyers defend themselves in the Eastern Mediterranean from oncoming drones? Their technology is world class, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And by the way, I'm thrilled to talk about it. I commanded USS Barry, an Arleigh Burke class destroyer, second of the class. I commanded a squadron, eight of these destroyers in combat. I commanded many of them.
We're going to focus. I'm going to interrupt right now, folks. Right. We're focusing on this today because of all the media blather. I get it. I love it. I'm glad we're doing it at Bloomberg. This is the adult on your men and women at sea. Admiral, continue on the Arleigh Burke and the Barry.
So the ships are about 500 feet long, 66 feet wide. But here's the punchline, Tom. They carry about 95 anti-air and land attack missiles. They have an unmatched capability to defend themselves. 350 sailors aboard, two helicopters on most of the ships in the class. And they've been used most recently over the last 48 hours in the Red Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean, knocking down the Iranian air attack and doing so quite effectively.
Right. What's important here, and folks, we got an idea of a 19-year-old on the deck of an aircraft carrier. I think it's something we all understand from Vietnam forward. Max Hastings grabs that beautifully in his book on Vietnam. Admiral Stavridis, do you have like a 19-year-old kid handling a Phalanx close-in weapon system, CIWS, for point defense against drones from Iran?
Absolutely. There'll be somebody, maybe 20, 25 at the most, sitting in the Combat Information Center with his or her finger on the button for that CWIS system, as we call it. It's a Gatling gun that fires uranium projectiles. If any of the missiles get through the air defenses, the longer range ones, we use those close in. But the whole ship is manned by very young people. When I was captain of the ship, I was 37 years old.
This, folks, is just so important. And I got to get one more question here because Paul's looking at me like, when do I get to talk? And Admiral Stavridis, just where are we in our Navy development? We've got this whole thing that we've stopped our shipbuilding, but I don't mean the Gerald Ford and the ginormous platform. How many more Barrys and Burkes do we develop?
We're going to be bringing out a new class, USS Constellation class frigate that's almost as big as these guided missile destroyers. First one is having her keel laid this week, as a matter of fact. So the follow-on classes, frankly, will be even better than these Arleigh Burkes, and they're pretty damn good.
Admiral, it's been a busy week in that part of the world over there with the Iranian response and shelling of Israel. Put it into context of how at risk are our ships and our men and women in that part of the world, and how do we protect them better, perhaps?
Our sailors are on board the unmatched, most capable warships in the world. They can absolutely defend themselves in any scenario. But there's always a possibility of a missile slipping through, of a mistake being made in a radar, bad intelligence has you looking in the opposite direction. These kind of incidents can happen. So thus far, none of our ships, our warships, have been struck by Iranian or Houthi ballistic missiles or drones. But the sailors there absolutely have to stay on their toes to execute their mission, not only defending themselves, but defending our allies in the region like Israel.
Admiral, what do you expect from Israel over the coming days and weeks here? It just feels like we've kind of gotten into this stalemate type of situation in that part of the world.
The Israelis have said they will respond to this 350 drone ballistic missile, cruise missile attack. Fortunately, the air defenses we're discussing destroyed it, knocked down 350 of them, essentially. But Israel will respond. However, Paul, I don't think it'll be a massive jets whistling above Tehran kind of response. I think it'll include offensive cyber, maritime operations, special operations. Don't look for a big escalation at this point.
One more question, Admiral. We're only doing this because we want you to come back on the show. I noticed that the USS Barry was named 2 years ago the Navy's top Pacific Fleet sub hunter. Bring that over to the Hormuz Strait. How much risk do we have of Iran without our technology like the USS Barry shutting down the Hormuz Strait?
Iran could shut it down, Tom, with mines, putting mines in the water. That's why our minesweepers are stationed over there. Our allies have minesweeping capability. And then finally, the Iranians also have diesel submarines. quite quiet, quite capable, but a ship like USS Barry should be able to handle that threat as well. Watch the mine sweeping. That would be the way they would close the strait.
Admiral, thank you so much this morning. Admiral Stavridis, of course, I can't say enough about 2034 and just out, moving on to the technology that we can't imagine. Elliot Ackerman and James Stavridis, 2054. Yep. It is my book of the summer. Your daily look at the front pages around the world. Sue Decker, ex-DLJ.
Great. The best.
Iconic.
The best.
Sue Decker's on the board at Costco. She emailed. She did like a DM. Like, not email, a DM on Twitter.
I'm not sure what that is,
but Lisa,
okay, go ahead.
That's like a, where you talk inside.
Oh, okay. All right.
To Lisa Mateo. Did you really spend $500 at Costco?
$580, easy, to be exact. It's fair.
Mrs. Keene's looking at your photo going, my God, we don't eat like that. They eat healthy.
It's my once a month kind of go in there. And you got to stock up. I have the extra freezer. I have the extra fridge.
You do? Is that in the garage? So,
I put them in the garage.
Yeah.
And so they're there.
Is that where the beer is?
That's where the beer is.
Okay, so when I come over, Tom and I come over, we know where to go.
But it's healthy beer. It's gluten-free beer. Sue Decker at Costco says, thank you. Thank you. What do you got?
Yeah, that was quite a time. So we talked about Netflix. That one was crazy from the New York Times. I want to talk about, we've been talking so much about squatters.
Yep.
This one stood out to me from Business Insider. Squatters have taken over Gordon Ramsay's restaurant in London. Believe it or not, at least six people, they're living there outside York and Albany. This is according to the BBC too. The restaurant was temporarily closed, so that's why this happened, and they're not sure when the squatters first showed up, but they're calling themselves the occupiers. They have a sign outside. They posted a sign. They locked themselves inside. They boarded up the windows. They're threatening legal action against anybody who tries to kick them out. Ramsay's called the authorities about the property, but so far they're still there. So
it's a small matter.
It's wild.
And New York Mayor Adams is focused on, you know, the rights of both sides of the transaction.
I don't see
it. It's brutal.
I don't.
There was a Yahoo Finance chart out over the weekend on where the inflation is. Mm-hmm. Rent, number two.
Yep.
Home ownership, number three. That's all there is to it. I'm sorry.
Yep.
Our audience is correct. The people we talk to are wrong. They're all micromanaging inflation. I'm sorry, people are getting crushed.
Yep, absolutely.
You know, maybe groceries are better now, but I don't buy it. What else do you have?
The New York Post, the once popular power lunch. Remember, we've been talking about, you know, people, maybe they're trickling back to the office. Apparently they're coming back because the power lunch is making a comeback. Okay, this is according to Side Dish. A number of Midtown restaurants, newer hotspots, they're reporting the power lunch expanded not just from Tuesday to Thursday, but 5 days a week.
Really?
Yeah, so they're enjoying the food. They're making big deals. And here's something interesting. Ladies who lunch.
Oh, I love that.
That is back. So the women are making the deals too. They're going out for lunch more. Friday's the more popular lunch day because the workers don't go back to the office after lunch. So you can kind of make a longer lunch, maybe a 2-3 martinis.
I'm sorry, but good morning, Michael McCarty and Steve Millington. And I mean, the bottom line is, there I was power lunching on Friday.
Yep.
I was stunned how busy it was given Wednesday's the new Friday.
Nice.
And I actually was talking
good.
To Steve about it, and you know, he totally agrees with what the New York Post is saying. There's just a new step, a new pop. Let's go. I hope it continues. I think people know how biased I am on this.
I'll be at the LA Gourmet Deli power lunching today with my sandwich. But I know, usually I'm at Michael's, Tom. That's my go-to spot. That's where the media folks hang out.
That's like,
Michael's.
You know, media. I just sit at the bar. You know what I saw there? Nick Colas.
Well,
he was in some intense private meeting. I think he was trying to sell Google or something. But Nick Colas came. He was there.
Yeah,
he was having the green asparagus with the French sauce I can't pronounce. Next.
Fancy stuff. And this is the last one. It's a bit of a battle going on at the gym because a lot of these influencers are taking their phones and they're filming themselves. And they're posting all these things. The people in the background, they don't want to be on their feed. So it's this back and forth thing about people saying stop filming yourself at the gym, enough of it already.
Do you film yourself at the gym?
Yeah, I was going to say, you're looking at us like you guys have no idea what we're talking about.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Do you have your phone out at the gym, Lisa?
Well,
audience wants to know.
The thing is, I work out at home. I don't go to the gym.
And you've got the power gym. This is not like the Peloton, Tom. like, or like the little walking on a treadmill. No, she's got like three weights and barbells.
Yeah, it's
and
like
all this
there's
craziness.
A house. It's like three houses down from Dan Loeb in the Hamptons.
Yep.
I don't know who owns it.
Yep.
And it's like literally 4,000 square feet of gym equipment.
Yep.
Do you have something like that?
Not 4,000, but maybe a little piece of that. But all of my friends who go to the gym, that's what they complain about. They're like, enough of this already. Like, do your workout. You're taking up my time on the bench. You're doing this. And so
because you
got to
get your phone all set up and the lighting and all
and
that kind of stuff.
Okay, we're going to get serious here.
Much.
And good morning,
much.
Jeremy Eyther, who I adore out in Vancouver, is just phenomenal out on YouTube and has really helped me a lot in trying to keep this aged body going. Lisa, how long should you work out with weights? How many
with
minutes?
With weights, no less than 2 days a week.
Oh, no, he's Jeremy's nope. 4 days or more.
Oh, there you
well,
go.
This crazy
what
person
time?
Yeah,
what's
five?
I see guys in the gym, and they're there for 3 hours. What
no,
are they doing?
Too much.
Yeah.
They don't want to go home.
Yeah.
That's their
well,
excuse.
Well, how many minutes do you work out in a given day with weights?
Me, 40 minutes. That's it.
40 minutes.
40 minutes.
But today all is today an arms day or a leg
today
day?
Today is arms day.
Today's
yeah,
arms day.
Shoulders and abs.
After the trip?
Yeah. What's for you? Arms day, legs day?
I do a hockey workout. I do it in less than 20 minutes, and I get about 80%, 75% done, because I don't have time for this stuff.
No,
not
please.
Like Lisa.
No, you don't have to
and,
be there that long.
And I am taking photos.
Yes, exactly.
Posting tag me next time.
Pharaoh still talks about me in the gym, because I'm actually lifting weights.
Okay.
The rest of them are doing three sets in that.
What is Pharaoh doing?
I do like Nassim Taleb. Nassim Taleb does this. You do like one set, get over it, and move on.
I don't
That's
know.
It.
I'm just going to follow Lisa. She's the expert
oh,
here
she's,
in the room.
Yeah.
Yep.
She's
all right.
She's
but
great.
No. But
yes.
But the bottom line is
bottom
stop
line
filming yourself
is
in the gym.
Stop filming yourself.
Okay.
People are tired of it. They don't want to be seen. It's actually some legal issues too are starting to develop from this. So
yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Listen,
I want to
be
in the background of your social media posts.
Yeah, yeah.
This is according to the Wall Street Journal. Okay. Very
yes.
good. Yes. All right, Lisa.
Okay.
Thank you so much. We
thank you, Lisa.
It.
That was brilliant. Starting strong here.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast, bringing you the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Visit the Bloomberg Podcast channel on YouTube to see the show weekday mornings from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern from our global headquarters in New York City. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen, and always on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Terminal, and the Bloomberg Business App.